just going to try to shut this baby down.
Shut it down!
Shut it down!
Kathy's worried about her audio. I'm worried about sounding like a moron. JR, what are you worried about?
Climate change?
Yeah, that's valid.
Whether or not Sam is going to show up in the Quantum Leap reboot?
I could finally... Maybe tonight? Definitely by Friday. I can't wait to watch it. That, with Kathy accompanying on the Kleenex tissue, that is the remix the world needs.
Where's my horn section? Yeah.
Oh my God, my allergies. All right.
Welcome to episode 334 of The Fascinating Podcast, the podcast about the fascinating people and events at the heart of our cultural conversations. I'm J.R. Forresteros.
I'm Kathy Kong.
And I'm Clay Morgan.
Matt Michelotis is back in the writer's room, so not with us this week. But on this week's show, we're going to be talking about an historic moment in American cultural history and the ongoing legacy of school integration. But before that, there was a kind of a bombshell study that dropped earlier this week from R.C. Sproul's. It's like a state of the theology survey from I'm not sure how to say this, Clay. It's a town in Pennsylvania, Ligonier.
Yeah, I was just gonna say. Ligonier, very famous Pennsylvania area. I know that Sproul was always out of there. Is he still alive? Yep.
I don't think so. I think
his son took over like years ago, I think, or something. I can't recall.
So they released a state of theology thing. And what has been causing some shockwaves across the evangelical web is the fact that so many evangelicals are in agreement on what we might call social issues like abortion and homosexuality. But on things that most pastors and theologians would consider more central issues, like whether or not Christ is God, there's this wide gap. There are, I think it was, I'm looking here, 43% of evangelicals specifically, this is not everyone, this is specifically evangelicals, believe that Jesus was a great teacher, but he was not God.
Hmm.
What?
You keep using that word. I don't think you know what it means.
73%, so almost 3 out of 4 evangelicals agree with the statement that Jesus is the first and greatest being created by God. So this is a denial of Trinitarian theology. This is saying that Jesus is not the son of the Trinity, he's the first created being, which is actually something that Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses believe. It's one of the things that distinguishes them from mainline Christianity. And yet 3 out of 4 evangelicals believe this.
It's almost like evangelicalism isn't about Jesus.
What?
So this has been one of the observations that even some very conservative-leaning pundits and bloggers have made, is that Kristen Dumez, who we had on the show a couple seasons ago to talk about her terrific book, Jesus and John Wayne, where she argues that evangelicalism is not a theological movement, it's a political social movement. Things like this back that up, right? Many, borderline most evangelicals believe things that have been condemned as heresies almost since the beginning of the church, and yet they agree on things like abortion and homosexuality and race and stuff like that. And so, yeah, it seems to be less about what are the things that are true about God, and more about what are the political postures that bind us together in our culture war.
Wow. I mean, when we were growing up, or even into our adult years, the one thing you knew for sure was that anybody who was in a church that was calling themselves Christian, like, they might not know anything about the world or anything else, but they definitely knew Jesus was God incarnate, right? Like, that's It's like the one thing that anybody would have agreed on, I would have thought.
So here's the problem, though, Clay. When you say Jesus is God incarnate, these are all like theological words that people may know that that's what they're supposed to say. But then if you ask them, so what does it mean to be incarnate? They may not know. Right? They may not understand what incarnation is, what that theological language is. And then more importantly, they certainly then don't have any idea why that belief matters and how that's meant to form us to be God's people, you know? And if you don't know that, if all you're supposed to know, like one of my favorite things to do is to ask pastors and preachers when they say, well, you know, it's just all about grace. I'm like, cool. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, isn't that the problem with the way evangelicalism is, quote, taught? Is that it is very, it's taught. There is no questioning. There is no going back and forth. There is very little, I mean, I know pastors are supposed to give application, but usually the application is not around first taking apart theological ideas into practical daily life. And so, like you said, JR, we can talk about incarnate, but what does that mean in reality? Which is why then people would say, yeah, Jesus is God's first created being. And I'm a little horrified because that is not what we believe, or at least that's not what I believe.
I was going to say the cynic in me pictures at least a couple of churches I've attended where they're not spending Sunday mornings explaining theological matters or spiritual practice. You know, they're basically,
very few are.
They're using that pulpit time to make sure you understand what a liberal is and how to not become fake gay. Like, they're just focusing on all these other things.
Right. And I think that is the way it is presented now. But I also think that that's probably the way it has been presented for decades. Right. But it's not framed in those words and it's not taught in that way specifically. But now it is. It very much is. Well, you know, the libs, we're going to own the libs. But more it was, you know, like, well, Christians don't do X and here's why. Christians don't do this and here's why. Under this vague idea of what we believe. And if you believe this without actually interrogating what that means and the implications, you just know that that's what you're supposed to say you believe and then be able to iterate all of the other things that you're not supposed to do is the big gap and also still horrifying.
And you know, I think we've all probably encountered pastors and preachers who will say something like, yeah, the Trinity's just confusing, so don't worry about it.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Instead of saying the Trinity is pretty confusing, so we should take time, be careful, and, you know, meditate on it.
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that. Right.
Right.
Right. So anyway, I'm sure we'll come back to this. It's such an interesting identifier.
Man, that is stunning. Like, I didn't know this at all. I hadn't heard this at all. Just starting to process it in my brain. It's really stunning.
Right. I mean, it kind of gets worse the longer you think about it. So, it has a lot of really troubling implications.
Actually explains a lot.
Right.
We've already got troubling implications. This helps explain them a little more.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, as far as solutions and things like that, you know, one, I think we could do a whole show on this, but part of it is you have to ask if the people who are the problem even think it's a problem. Right. The people who don't understand the Trinity or think that Jesus is God's firstborn son, you know, you have to ask if they care, if they think having a theology that aligns with the historic church's theology actually matters that much, or if it, what's more important is that they are anti-abortion and anti-gay.
Yeah, and like, you know? And when I say things like what I'm about to say, a lot of times to me it's just so obvious and non-inflammatory, I don't even think about it. I'm sure this will be surprising to some people, but there's obviously a cross-section of bigots and racists who are just looking for where they're provided the greatest cover, and that just may happen to be the evangelical church right now.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's true. So,
and historically.
Yeah.
As
yeah.
we will.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
History,
later. Hey.
So Kathy, let me tell you a story.
Yes.
Once upon a time, we were planning a show on school segregation, school integration, and the anniversary of the famous Little Rock Nine. And we have a resident historian on the podcast, Clay Morgan, you know, big deal. Sure you've heard of him. And Clay invited my wife and me to do some bar trivia at the movie theater / pub by their house, Alamo Drafthouse Cedars.
World's greatest.
So we went. We went and did Geeks Who Drink Trivia at the theater. We ended up coming in second place because I came through peer pressure and didn't trust Clay. Okay. So
we lost by one. We tied. It was a full and then lost the tie and there was a tiebreaker.
Oh, no.
But there was a question that Clay got right.
We should give there were a couple questions that Clay got right that JR overrode.
No, there was one. And JR overrode it because he got peer pressured by the rest of the team. And Clay was right. And if I had just listened to Clay, listeners, if we had just listened to Clay, we would have won.
Oh.
Okay. So let's take from that what you will.
What a powerful segue.
Yeah. But here was one of the questions.
Okay.
In what year did the famous Little Rock Nine go to a white school and become integrated?
Well, there was
the
actually
very
a,
thing we're
there was
talking
actually a
about
multiple
today.
Choice.
Yeah, well, yeah. But the very thing we're talking about today was a question last night in our bar trivia.
Yep. How about that?
Okay. So the entire table
was wrong?
No. No, Clay got it right.
Well, Clay got it right, but the rest of the table was wrong.
The rest of the table had no idea. Oh, this was not the question. This was not the question I didn't trust Clay on.
No.
That was a different question. Yeah. That question was what country lies between Ethiopia and the Red Sea? And it's a country that starts with E.
That's the face Jen made, Kathy.
So I'm just going to blame U.S. school and its lack of emphasis on geography. Like, I could find it on a map. I just don't know it in my
it's
head.
Fair. Almost immediately, I said Eritrea. And the table decided to go with Egypt.
Of course you did.
To be fair.
We went with Egypt.
To be fair.
Mean, Egypt and the sea, kind of, but the Red Sea, the parting of, but. Yeah.
There were three moments. There were three moments where I came against JR. One, I adamantly said, despite your certitude, sir, I am right and change it. And I was right because I really knew I could take a stand. But there were a couple other times where there was a debate and I didn't have the confidence. I didn't really know myself to be true. And Eritrea, I was not real sure. I just kind of thought Egypt does make more sense. So I would have taken a stand, JR would have followed my leadership, but I just didn't have the fortitude on that one.
Oh, okay. All right. That's true. Okay, so we're saying it's the 65th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yep.
So would it be minus 65 of the current year?
It would.
But
be.
also, remember, I'm a word person, journalism. So math, not my thing. Numbers, not good.
Who are you telling? Yeah, 65 years ago this month is 1957. So that is the timing of this event we're talking about today. And I am curious, you know, how many people have heard of the Little Rock Nine? How many people know much about the Little Rock Nine? You know, if it's completely off the radar, if it's still just prominently remembered alongside a very related civil rights event, the Brown versus the Board of Education case, right?
Right.
So, Kathy, just off the top of your head, what do you know about Brown versus the Board of Education? What were they trying to figure out?
They were trying to figure out whether or not they could legally separate black children from white children. so long as they said it was, you know, equal.
Equal, fair. Separate, but equal, right?
Yeah. Separate, yeah. But equal, right? With scare quotes in the air. And I'm still kind of thinking about, like, oh, some people may say, wow, that was a long time ago. And in my mind, it's like, oh, that was not very long ago.
Yeah.
65 years was not that long ago.
You know, it's so true. I think about when I was a history student, and then I was a history teacher, and now I was just a history lover in middle age. It's amazing how your understanding of time and context changes as you age. Like, what was like forever ago, it's like, wow, that's not that long. You know, that's just one me away. So it's crazy when you really think, it's crazy when you think about it. But that's right. They were trying to litigate a philosophy that was played out in very practical ways. And so from 1896 specifically on, after an old case called Plessy v. Ferguson, the ruling doctrine was that we could be separate but equal, right? That we could have separate facilities, for example, dedicated towards white people and black people, but as long as they were of equal accommodation, that it was perfectly legitimate and just. Spoiler, they were never actually equal in accommodation or quality. Double spoiler, it wasn't actually just, which, of course, many people felt and knew and lived all along. So this is why you hear about, you know, the water fountains. Sometimes, you know, there were still buildings around the country today where you could see the legacy of split bathrooms. And there were cemeteries for white people that did not allow black people to be buried in them. There were, of course, differences in movie theaters, if not entire buildings, then a balcony section that was separated. Hospitals, famously. So you could literally be in medical crisis, but if you had the wrong skin color, you could not gain access to the nearest hospital in a life-threatening situation. And very prominently, a category that was caught up in this is, of course, schools, school buildings, right? So when we hear so much about the civil rights movement and all of those efforts to gain awareness and to make change, and we see a lot of that come to fruition in the 1960s, at least legislatively, those battles, of course, were fought for so long up until that point, continued to be fought since then. So the 1950s is a real ground zero for so many of these situations, right? Not surprisingly, coming out of World War II, where we sent segregated troops to fight against tyranny. And even Harry Truman was like, I'm not very smart, but, you know, that kind of doesn't seem logical.
Right? The irony there.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's where we were in the 1950s. And as you said, Brown versus the Board of Education is this famous Supreme Court case that pulled together a number of different plaintiffs and situations and became the court's chance at a high level to make an umbrella ruling. So, JR, before we hop into kind of the execution of this with the Little Rock Nine, what do you know about kind of how things were happening between 1954 and 57? What happened to separate but equal?
Yeah, so I will say this is stuff I've learned a lot in recent years doing my own research, because growing up, it was always, oh, like exactly what you said, right? Black kids and white kids are not allowed to be in the same building. And that was the end of it, right? But I think one of the things that how do you measure equality, right? There's a couple of different ways to do that. One is you can measure outcomes. So are students performing to the same level in both of these different places? Another one is actually, though, money. How much is the state spending on each kid? Right? Do the white kids have as much money spent on them as the black kids? And what you actually find out when you go back and look is that, to your point, Clay, right? No one's surprised here, but it was wildly unequal, not just in the South, actually all over the country. Anywhere that the schools were segregated, the white schools got a significantly higher chunk of money, and that came from federal, state, and local levels than students of color. To the point where, like, for every dollar spent on a white kid, it would be like pennies on a black kid, right?
That isn't and a chair, a chair.
Well, that's it, right? But we think about this today, like, you know, I remember when our school, my public school, got internet. Well, if your school's going to have internet, it needs to have computers. Well, how nice are the computers, right? What kind of software comes on them? All of these things cost money. When you go to your science classes, what kind of equipment do you have? Do you actually get to perform experiments and do labs? Or is everything just on a whiteboard? Oh, not a whiteboard, excuse me, a chalkboard, right? I mean, they're like when you really get into what equipment the schools have for the kids, that's where it comes from, right? It's not literally every kid gets a certain amount of money. It's when you look at this school, if this school got $10,000 to do a technology upgrade, did the other school get $10,000 to do a technology upgrade, right? And I mean, I think that's a little bit easier for us to see today than back then, but it was the same kind of a thing, right?
We've talked about not only gerrymandering on the show, by the way, but you just talked about concrete and infrastructure and bridges last year, right? We had a show around that article right. You wrote, and not only the reality of the infrastructure, but how it groups people. And of course, we put kids into schools based on neighborhoods and communities and geographical areas.
Right. So now you're starting to get into how the U.S. has maintained school segregation in the wake of Brown versus Topeka.
Because okay, so we should probably circle back to this.
Yeah. Because the reality is nothing much has changed despite this landmark ruling, which again was a massive shock to me when I started learning that. Because growing up, I always learned I went to school with black kids and Asian American kids and, you know, Latino kids and all that. So I was like, oh, like, see, it worked. Like, we're not racist anymore. Yeah. You know?
Do you think people see the difference more now than they did back then? I don't know if people really understand when it comes down to it. But yes, we should circle back.
Yeah, let's
I think the reality is people are like, well, is it really that bad?
Well, that's a great...
Sure, if you look at the extremes, right? But when it comes down to it, people are like, well, you know, that school on the other side of the county, is it really that bad?
Mm-hmm.
Versus, you know, the water that I'm drinking in Libertyville versus Jackson, Mississippi. And what does that have to do with school? Everything.
Yeah. So I like this context to set up this event, right? Because it speaks to so many different realities. And by the way, you could go hop on YouTube probably in 30 seconds and just go find like whatever the nightly news footage was watched by 40 million people. You just go find conversations where reporters are putting microphones in front of like white people's faces and being like, what do you think about allowing these black children to come into the schools? Like, well, it's never going to happen as long as I'm here. Like, surrounded by the whole community. Like, this is just the prevailing mindset and conversation. So I think we'll come back around to that specific thought, Kathy, about where people's attitudes are and whether they're just masked better or not, or how much real change we've seen. But let's talk about what happened here. A couple of years out from Brown versus the Board of Education, in some places, integration went fairly smoothly, or at least it didn't create historic tremors. And we come to Little Rock Central High School. So in 1957, the Arkansas chapter of the NAACP, led by Daisy Gaston Bates, worked to find some families and students that were willing to make this big transition and to go into an all-white school. So the Little Rock Nine refers to the nine students who entered the classroom this month 65 years ago. They are, there's some very distinguished people on this list, by the way. We'll talk later on about where they ended up in life. But Minnie Jean Brown, Elizabeth Eckford, and Elizabeth Eckford is the famous iconic photo of this event. If you've ever seen the young stoic lady with her books trying to walk to class, and she's surrounded by a white mob yelling, including one high school-aged white girl who is just filled with so much venom and hatred in this iconic photo that it's shocking. Elizabeth Eckford, Ernest Green, Thelma Mothershed, Melba Patillo, Gloria Ray, Terrence Roberts, Jefferson Thomas, and Carlotta Walls. And I actually had a chance to hear Ernest Green speak. He came to my alma mater when I was a student. He was in the Clinton administration. He did a lot of different stuff. Ernest Green happened to be the only senior of the nine. So they were all heading into at least a couple years of a high school experience. And as we'll see, a lot of unexpected things that happened. So those are the nine students. And on the morning that it was time to finally make this really scary entrance into this world, they were a little nervous because from the governor of the state on down, they were basically being threatened. And eight of the nine families had a telephone, but Elizabeth Eckford did not. And that's why she's in that iconic photo, because poor woman, not only would this have been terrifying to go with all of your friends, she ends up out there alone taking this walk, which is why she's in this image. So these nine students, they attend school, and they had varying experiences. Some of them were literally directly impacted by physical violence. There was, of course, a lot of intimidation and factors across the board. But what we see is that the governor of the state, using the excuse that he was worried about their safety and that this shouldn't happen, he actually called in the Arkansas National Guard. And now we have a real constitutional crisis in the air. So the president of this era is Dwight Eisenhower. Dwight Eisenhower, famous guy. He had been the leader of all of the Allied forces in World War II, famously known as Ike, and he was the president from 1952 to 1960. Eisenhower was pretty typical for your older white guy of the time. Actually, he was atypical in a lot of ways. He definitely did some surprising things that ended up having a real positive legacy. He helped pull back a lot of the angry war rhetoric that fueled the Cold War. He helped establish the United Nations, and he warned us of the military-industrial complex on his way out of office in his grandpa sweater. But along the way, he just was he was at best neutral to blind on the reality of race problems. And obviously, that's a significant issue when you're the president of the United States in the 1950s or any decade. So Governor Orville Faubus, which you look at his name and you look at his face and you hear him say two words on footage, I mean, he is every bit the racist Southern governor of the 1950s you could possibly typecast. And Faubus ends up in this showdown with Eisenhower. Now, because the Supreme Court had ruled that separate is not equal and that schools had to be integrated, any action by a state governor to keep integration from happening was definitely a violation of the Constitution. Of course, you know what the people in the South said, right? When it came down to
state rights.
I bet they had some.
Show me school buildings in the Constitution. It's not mentioned in the Constitution, so that means we get to decide states' rights, all that stuff, right? So it's really interesting because you have a national press that is very mixed at this time. There's a few people that are super crusaders for civil rights. Of course, there's no black reporters. They haven't ascended into that level of journalism. And you've got like a young John Chancellor down there. And it was really interesting. Like some reporters were attacked just for covering it, right? And things like that. But these students basically are now up against an entire state National Guard. So Eisenhower calls in the U.S. military, the U.S. Army. So
I did not know this.
It's crazy. John Chancellor said that when the troops showed up from the 101st Airborne out of Kentucky, to him, again, a young white guy who's a reporter from New York City covering this situation in the South, who himself was accosted. He escaped, by the way, by holding up a microphone. All he had was like a battery-powered cassette recorder, but he held up a microphone to the mob and he was like, "You do what you want to me, but anything you do is going to be heard around the world." And at least the mob was too dumb to understand, you know, batteries and telecommunications. So he escaped that scenario. But he said, "When I saw those army personnel 1,200 of them marching down the street in Little Rock. He said, I saw the Constitution coming our way and this possibility for progress and change, as potentially violent as it was. So Eisenhower tells Orville, like, not going to happen, take a seat. And the police, you know, are there to then locally be on hand, but the Arkansas National Guard is pulled back. And now the military are literally in the town with the police, like, lining the sidewalks so that day after day these kids can come to school. It's a crazy, crazy scenario when we think of how little has changed and how much has changed. But, like, to imagine just the ability to walk down the street and enter a building was met with this much violence. And violence there was. So that is the group that we refer to when we talk about the Little Rock Nine, sometimes called the Arkansas Nine, right? It's this flashpoint where you can make a radical decision at the highest level in a court, but what happens when, you know, bodies actually personify what now the Constitution is said to be? And it was incredibly tense. Martin Luther King Jr. did show up when Ernest Green earned his diploma. And there's more towards the story. And this might tee you up even better. But I want to share one last fact about this and see if you guys know this. So ineffective was Faubus at being able to shut down this actual integration. They closed down for 1958, the following year, they closed down all public schools. And put it, they said it was up for a public vote. And you can go watch news archived interviews of reporters just asking, like, okay, high school white senior, what do you think about the fact that your school shut down? I think it's the right thing. It's the only thing that needs to happen until we get this, like, and every word you could imagine just being tossed out in casual interview conversation. So there was actually an entire delay of the entire education system because they would rather have no school for anybody than black children be allowed to attend an integrated school. So that's what was happening in Arkansas in the late 1950s.
So I want to make a couple observations about that. First of all, when we say white supremacy is bad for white people too, this is the sort of thing we're talking about. This is so much a cut off your nose to spite your face moment. Clay, I think you said it perfectly when you said so much violence was brought to bear just to keep some people from entering a building. You know, imagine how the white kids were being formed. Imagine being one of the white kids in that picture you were talking about, right? And knowing that that's your legacy, is the look on your face as you were watching a kid who just wanted to have a good education, right, come into your space.
Well,
and by the way, very distinguished.
What, like, did they know?
These kids went on and did some stuff too, right? So we're talking, like, you should be glad to have the student body enhanced by these minds and abilities.
Do you think that, I guess I haven't done enough research or read up, but I do wonder what the legacy is for those white students and what the families of those kids think about that time, because they are adults now, right? And I can completely see how folks would just brush it off as, well, you know, they're 18, 19, you know, 14, what do they know? They're just kids, right? So there is also that excuse and the pass that white kids will get and whiteness gets all the time.
Yeah, and you just wonder, I wonder, right? Was this a moment? Was this a time, not just a moment, obviously, because as Clay just mentioned, right, it has these long-lasting reverberations. Was this a time that retrenched them into the racism that they were raised in, or was it a time that served as a wake-up call to awaken them to the realities of how they had been racialized and an invitation for them into a more just possibility, you know?
I was going to say that young woman in that photo, her name's Hazel Bryan. And I haven't looked up. I remember back when I was teaching, I did look into it a little bit more because that photo is so iconic. People ask the question, like, what did she grow up to be? Like, what happened? And then I'm just looking at some notes from 2011. So 55 years after, you know, the case, she was the daughter of a disabled war veteran, largely apolitical. The photograph, by the way, when she was saying what she was saying, which is like literally you can read it in the footage and certainly almost in the photograph. Will Counts was the young photographer who took the picture. But you can go out and read. There's actually an entire book about these two and like what they represented about America. But I don't know that there's any sense of I haven't found yet what Hazel Bryan eventually said.
Well, but isn't that interesting too? Is that that says as much about the current times as it does what happened in the past? Is that there is that tendency, there are certain things that we're going to remember. And yes, it's wonderful that we know the names of the nine and where they ended up, but it also is a disservice to history to not know where those students who were yelling and screaming and also captured in those images, like, we should also know those names and hold to account and a bit of learning from that experience.
So check this out. So I'm just reading this now. So I guess she realized that she was going to have kids and that people were going to realize that the person in the history books was their mother. So it says in sometime in 1962 or 1963, no cameras, she was Hazel, who was sitting in the trailer in rural, I'm reading from slate.com, in rural Little Rock, in which she and her family now live, picked up the Little Rock directory and looked under Eckford. Without telling her pastor or husband or anyone else, she dialed the number. Between sobs, she told Elizabeth that she was that girl and how sorry she was. Elizabeth was gracious. The conversation lasted a minute, if that. Pretty fascinating. So you can go to slate.com and read more about the many lives of Hazel Bryan, which looks like something I want to follow up on. But that's a great point, Kathy. How many people did not have that mirror held up in a way? And again, like if it hadn't been documented and become so famous, like that changes the impact of it, right? But it's really crazy to think about.
So I have a couple. I have one that I keep wanting to get back to, but I keep having other thoughts. I think another thing about white supremacy is how it offers us, and by us I mean white people like me and you, Clay, it offers us the protection of anonymity. You know, would Hazel have had that same reaction if she had not been drawn into the light by being put in the history books? Right? Would she? Maybe she would have. But I think it's significant. I think about Charlottesville and the Tiki Torch guys and how dumbfounded they were that people were identifying them, finding their LinkedIn profiles and contacting their employers. And that this like shock that they had at being held accountable, right? Because I think there's this like, there's this anonymizing that goes on. more cynically, someone said, at least back in the day, they were not, they were smart enough to wear hoods.
Right. Oh, good Lord. Well, but, you know, there's that.
But like, well, I think by the way, we're seeing it with Carolyn Bryant and the Emmett Till, like literally in the last month.
Yes.
I mean, J.W. Mylan and Roy Bryant, like I knew they were dead. I didn't even know she was still alive. And like the fact that she's still defiant.
Yeah.
Well, so that's white supremacy, right?
Yeah.
Is that it still is going to protect the narrative that paints whiteness as innocent and righteous and deserves all of the grace and Even if that conversation was a minute, right? It was really about Hazel absolving her guilt. And so, again, where's the responsibility for that? That was just about her unloading
decades. Unburdening herself.
Yeah. And so, again, I think that plays into, I think, the conversation that we started out with is, what do we really believe? And how does that play out in our lives? And so this understanding, this very weak understanding of theology and how that actually is lived out, has been playing out for centuries, right? Yeah. This is nothing new. This is nothing new, because a lot of those folks who are yelling and decided that it was better not to have school than to share a classroom with a Black classmate also went to church on Sundays and were pastors and pastors' wives and Sunday school teachers, and they had no problem. They had no problem.
You know, the other thing I was thinking about was along those lines, that when we talk about integration, what we see happening is Black kids being taken to white schools. What we never see happening is white kids going to the Black schools. And a large part of the reason for that was because of how much worse the educational experience is in the Black school, right? So, and that's the thing that has not changed nearly as much today.
Or an extension of that, if integration is welcomed even into the white schools or celebrated, how often is it because those students bring some kind of benefit through demographics, grants, athletic success? You know, there's a lot of different reasons that people are happy to celebrate integration in a way that is self-serving, much like with the Native Americans and the Carlisle, Pennsylvania school, and like, you know, you got Pop Warner and these football, you know, like the football legend who's named for all of the kids' programs. Like, oh, such a friend to the natives. No, man, just looking for a winning football team he literally could take out and beat Penn State and Harvard with. So there's a lot of legacies around education that are conflicted. And JR, I asked you last night if you could, you know, think a little bit more about a way to structure the conversation, like, how have things changed or not changed? And I know you've been doing some reading on that.
Yeah, I mean, so again, the reality is that what Brown versus Topeka did was made it legal for minority students to attend white schools. What it did not provide for was making sure that all students have the same amount of money spent on them, or anything about achievement, right? There was nothing. It was literally just like a spatial integration, which is not nothing. It's not nothing, but it doesn't go nearly far enough. And so what it did was what we've seen a lot of racial policies do, is that it kind of drove everything underground, because now you're not allowed to be outwardly, overtly segregationist. So it have to get more clever. You already mentioned redlining and all the housing discrimination stuff. So that when we say, well, we just have kids go to the schools by where they live, which seems totally reasonable and not in any way racialized, until you recognize that at the federal, state, and local level, we have been very careful about deciding who can live where for generations, so that now the schools are divided by race still largely. The majority of students, I will say this specifically, the majority of white students in America attend school with other white kids. It's a little different for kids of color, but it's also true. In 2018, there was a report that was published that said that school districts that enroll the most students of color receive about $1,800 or 13% less per student. Okay. And there's all kinds of ways that this gets subverted. If you are in a wealthy suburb, it's going to be predominantly white, and you're going to have a massive booster club, right? You're going to have parents that are raising money for band and for sports and for all this stuff. And so in addition to the local money that comes in, which is already going to be more than the local money that comes in from the more urban, in scare quotes, urban school, you're also getting like literally tens of thousands of dollars being dumped in to the school through the booster clubs, through the parents, through fundraising. That's just not happening in the schools that are predominantly kids of color. Mm. And so you get these, we still have massive, massive, massive inequities at the school level. When we talk about by the time a black kid graduates, they have had tens of thousands of dollars less invested in their education than a comparable white kid. And we know that quality of education matters, right? And right. So, I mean, there are so many additions to this. I mean, we talk about what kind of schools teachers want to work in.
Right. It's infrastructure, it's faculty and staff. It's all of the bells and whistles. It's the environment. It's, I mean, I remember moving from the Chicago public school on the north side, Waters Elementary, and moving to the west suburbs, Waterbury Elementary, and being blown away by the difference of the building itself and just walking in and realizing that I was in a completely different world. And when we moved, that would have been like 1978, 1979. We were the first Asian American family, and we may have been the first family of color in that elementary school district. And my sister and I felt it for sure. But I just remember distinctly walking in and being like, this does not look anything like the school I just left. From the playground to the entryway, that there were buses. I mean, that was wild. Like, everybody just walked Chicago Public School. But yeah, there were buses because it was drawing from a broader space, physical space. And I still think about that. I still think about how different that experience was.
I think a lot of things too in this conversation, I certainly have lived a very ordinary middle-class existence. You know, I have tons of privilege. I think a lot of the people who like know about the ghetto or know about really poorly developed and suffering areas, they don't actually see it. Like, I don't think we really have an understanding that in 2022, what impoverished parts of towns and specifically urban areas are really like. And even if you see it on like a Tuesday afternoon versus a Friday night, a Saturday night. And it just creates such a stark picture of how this legacy from the physical infrastructure, the gerrymandering, the institutions that have driven segregation, of how it really drives poverty and perpetuates the cycle. I just don't think most of us really see the full reality of it. We see Hollywood versions of it, and we celebrate the story of the talented voice or the prized fighter who escapes, you know? But this is still such a real legacy for so many millions of people that's still with us. And it's just hard to ignore.
Well, and I think this falls under the like, know better, do better, right? Brown versus Topeka, I grew up thinking it was the end of the conversation. Right. We did it. We integrated.
Yeah. And Thurgood Marshall, the lawyer, became the Supreme Court justice. And
right. Yeah. And I think we need to treat it as the beginning. Right. It was the first step in a long journey to making sure education is truly equitable. There's a lot more work to do. Not that the work is over. And so, yeah. And I mean, you know, Kathy, you're pretty heavily involved in local politics. Right. So, like, you know, like these things happen at the local level. Like, we're talking about local school board elections, right, and that kind of stuff, right? Like, that's where a lot of this stuff is being decided.
Right.
So, yeah, like we care who's in the White House, but it probably actually matters a lot more who's on your local school board.
Right. And I am thinking about, you know, even at the level of what are the kids reading, right? And the whole conversation around banned books and what the curriculum is going to look like and what's being taught. I mean, imagine if this isn't being taught, right? And I can imagine and I can believe that this won't be taught, because whether or not you think it's the beginning or the end, it still shines a light onto what the reality was at that time. And that's a reality that I think a lot of people want to forget as much as possible, so that it cannot be connected to the present.
Well, I would encourage everyone to read more, not only about this event and the civil rights movement, but specifically, it's pretty cool to find out the stories of the Little Rock Nine, and they make it quite easy for you. You can go to Little Rock Nine, that's the number nine, littlerocknine.com. These folks are still going, man. They've got like contact information. You can bring them as a speaker. You could reach out to them. Maybe you could even have someone come speak to a school, or, you know, hopefully they've got even the ability to appear remotely. But I mean, Terrence Roberts became Dr. Terrence Roberts, Carlotta Lanier, just a rock star in multiple halls of fame. And they all received the Congressional Gold Medal, and they've all been honored by presidents. Melba Beals, who was kicked and had acid thrown at her at that school, had a long career, continues as an inspirational speaker. Just remarkable stuff. So littlerocknine.com, you can go and learn more about their stories.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Clay, for putting this episode together. It's been really interesting. I think we want to shift now to what is fascinating us this week.
Can I go first?
Please do. I would just like to say, though, I'm doing this in protest because I have seven things and I only get one. So, Clay,
you cannot have what's seven fascinating things this week. No,
yeah. I know, Kathy. I'm only going to do one.
Why don't you start a "What's Fascinating JR" podcast, and then you can just talk about all the things.
I thought that's what this was.
Follow JR Forresteros on Twitter or Facebook for more things he likes or doesn't like. And I'm not even going to take these two on the Elvis movie. But let me talk about a much better film.
Agreed.
You guys, I saw The Woman King on Sunday
I'm
night.
I'm so jealous.
Oh,
very
my
excited
goodness.
To see this one.
I've missed a lot lately. I didn't know multiple TV shows and movies were coming out.
Yeah, but you made time for Elvis. And,
yeah, months ago. And Jen told me, we got to see The Woman King. We went. Holy cow. Like, just give Viola Davis the Oscar, first of all. Granted, with all due respect to 5 months of more movies coming, she's got to be in the conversation, I'm guessing, pretty hardcore. If you are, like many people, unfamiliar with what The Woman King is, it's a new historical epic about the Agoge, the all-female warriors who defended the Dahomey in Africa. It is such a, it is an action film. And I wonder what the average person thinks of when they think of Viola Davis, right? Probably a particular role or whatever it is, it's about to change forever. Like, that's all I can tell you. Like, there is who you think Viola Davis is, and then there is who you see her as after you watch this film, which is really remarkable, despite, you know, all the COVID challenges of bringing a production to bear. They put a lot of money into the film. It's already outperformed expectations by a wide margin in its opening days. It is so intense, but it's very good, and it's called The Woman King, and it stars a number of very talented people, including some breakout roles. I obviously am not going to spoil anything, but I think we're just starting to hear about this film. It's on your radar, both of you?
Oh, yeah. Planning to see it this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nice.
Kathy, what about you?
Yeah, so I have really enjoyed finding funny things just because I need to offset reality. And Peter and I watched a Netflix show called Mo. And the series is very loosely based on, well, maybe not so very, loosely based on Mohammed Amer's personal life as a Palestinian-American refugee. So that alone should make your eyebrows go, what? Because what's so funny about being a refugee? And yet he does this masterful job of kind of pulling out kind of the brutal, violent, terrifying moments of childhood and life, and then making the viewer kind of relate to the terror and the fear of everyday life, of fitting in at a new school, or being terribly embarrassed by your mother, or not living the kind of life and career expectations of your immigrant family. So I really enjoyed the show, and then went on to go find his two stand-up shows that are also online. So I would highly recommend the two shows, which I cannot remember, stand-up comedy, but Mo on Netflix.
Yeah, we watched the first episode and we're really impressed. I haven't got to keep going yet.
Yeah, I mean, Peter was like, it's a comedy, and we watched the first episode and I was like, what kind of comedy? All right, JR, what are you?
Very good. Well, JR, we're out of time, so we'll hear from you next week.
No, I want to shout out a new horror film that is out called Barbarian. I would say if you have not seen a trailer, don't watch a trailer. But even if you have seen a trailer, you've only seen about the first 20 minutes of the film. It is terrific. There are some really, really smart writing choices that I would love to discuss, but they would constitute spoilers. And it is just a movie that constantly keeps you guessing. Has a lot to say, but never gets preachy. It's just really fun. Terrific performances all around. Highly recommend it. I know Kathy Elias and I were texting about it, and we could not, between the two of us, could not convince you to go see it. But he and I both really enjoyed it.
I didn't have time. I had things to work on. I will go see it. I promise.
So yeah, it's terrific. It's getting to be spooky season. So highly recommend Barbarian. One of the many great films out in theaters right now.
I can't wait to see it. Let's wrap up with what we're doing. Oh, but first, Kathy, we told you that we narrowly were edged out last night in trivia. You know, we had to go to a tiebreaker in the building. And the final question was this. What is, according to the USDA, the amount
to the nearest pound.
To the nearest pound.
The nearest pound.
The amount of bananas the average American eats in a year, consumes in a year.
Oh, gosh.
What would you guess?
The average consumer bananas.
The average American consumes.
Average American. Oh, my gosh.
Bananas.
Is there, were you given a range?
Nope.
No. Okay.
It was not Price is Right rules.
Oh,
you just had to pick a number,
man.
And you had to be closer than the other team.
Okay, 25 pounds.
Oh, that was my first response. JR went with 28. And
the team went with 28.
And?
I know.
It's like 10.
10?
No, it's 13. It's 13.
13 pounds? 13. 13.
But guess what? We said 28, and the other team said 27, so they won.
Oh, my gosh.
But we were both like neck and neck still.
Oh. Yeah. Wait,
13
pounds?
That's it? So, Kathy, last week's interview, which, by the way, we didn't ask how it went without us.
Oh, we managed.
Sure, it was probably great.
We managed.
Yeah.
I think that's just assumed it went well.
The book is now out.
Yes. Yes. Voices of Lament, Reflections on Brokenness and Hope in a World Longing for Justice. It was edited by our fascinating friend, Natasha Sistrunk Robinson. A number of other authors and friends of the podcast were a part of the book. And so I think it was 29 women of color, going through Psalm 37. So it's just a really, it's a very rich book. You don't want to plow through it. You want to walk through it and read through very slowly. There's reflections, there's poetry, there's questions, there's the cover is gorgeous. So that is out. You can buy it wherever books are sold. And yeah. How about you, JR?
Nice.
What do you got going?
I have a couple of new articles up. The one that I mentioned last week about Sandman and him going to hell is up at Think Christian. So I talk about dream in hell and the heroine of hell, one of my favorite theological topics. That, again, a lot of evangelicals apparently don't even know about. Who could have predicted? And then I have a terrific article up at Tor.com. That's on Nope and the Bible verse at the beginning of Nope, where they let me go on for like 2,000 words about American Empire, Black liberation theology, and all the stuff in Peel, in Peel's film. So I was sure when I submitted it, there was way too much theology in there. And I told them I am like ready and waiting to pull it back. Just tell me what is too much. And they were like, we love it. This is terrific.
What if I told you we're not editing it? Yeah.
There were like very small edits that were largely like rewording some things here and there. No content stuff at all. So
JR Forsteris, noted Tor.com contributor. It's very exciting.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what I've got. Clay, you've got, how's your Medium post been doing, by the way? I saw it got a lot of buzz.
You know, you guys know how it is. You can bang your head off the wall, not sure what to write, and then you throw out some schlock and it goes viral. And then you write like this thing you feel like is a masterpiece and no one sees it. Like, that's just a common thing that happens when you're a content creator. You can never predict the response, the market, the reach, and all that. For me, it's been fun just getting back to writing. I did put out a piece on Medium. It's called Searching for Truth in an Infodemic Era. Terrible title. I get it. I know it's a bad title, but it's a better piece.
Doesn't matter. Bad title.
It's classic. Clay tells a story and then winds some things around. I had a lot of fun working on it off and on for months. But yeah, check it out. Medium.com. I'm there. And you can just search for Clay Morgan, Clay Morgan PA.
Nice.
Perfect. All right, friends. This has been episode 334. We'd love to hear what you think. So let us know at facebook.com/thefascinatingpodcast or find us on Twitter with the hashtag fascinating. We will be back next week with another terrific episode. Until then, take care of each other. Be safe out there. And let's integrate for real.